Lauren, I'll choose you because I have the same name, so I'm biased.
You mentioned the emphasis on health care and preventive medicine. What is the life expectancy?
I know it is a little longer than it is here. I'm hesitant to quote the exact number now.
We have to repeat the question.
Yes. To repeat the question, he wanted to know what the life expectancy is in Cuba. Do you know the exact number? I don't, but I know that it is longer than here in the U.S.
And I actually brought that information, if anybody is interested. I've got it in my file afterwards. But in the Hotel National, speaking of 100 years old, they have a whole chart of people who have lived past 100. And it's pretty long. And that's probably only the ones they know about. So I'm not saying you live longer if you go to Cuba. Just saying. Okay, good question. But I have to interject. You didn't ask this, but I will anyway, is the fact that part of the prevention is excellent. It's also a challenge because of the blockade of our embargo. And because the legislation in 1996, known as the Helms-Burton Act, basically moved from an embargo to an actual blockade, because ships that do business with Cuba are not allowed to trade with the United States for at least 6 months. So it has, of course, that's another damper on opportunities for people to actually be able to afford, countries to be able to afford that medicine. And there's certain medicines that only we manufacture that are not available, but there's also medicines and research, including ending lung disease and hepatitis C and a few others that aren't available to us. So everybody wins if we can end this stalemate. We have a woman right behind you, and then maybe we could circle around because we want to hear from everybody.
What changes do you expect when Raul steps down? I think it was going to be this year, wasn't it?
The election question. What changes do we expect when Raul Castro steps down? There were several presentations that we debated about making that are very long and important, such as the Cuban elections and how Cubans do elections. The other one is immigration, and I know I'm going to get asked about that, I hope. But the short answer is he was projected to end his role as head of the Communist Party, but not head of the military and some other hats he wears in February, but they voted, I believe in January, to extend that, December or January, until April. So right now, just as we were leaving Cuba, and we've got a great article, if anybody wants some more information, go to our Facebook page or sign up on our list, because we have some really great information about the entire elections process in Cuba, which is, of course, very different from ours. Many people think a myth is also that they have no elections, but yet they have a very, very long and powerful process, not in length of time, but in terms of grassroots candidates and the fact they cannot spend money on elections. So you're literally forced to meet people. Yes, I think we can applaud that, and at least I will. And that that people's qualifications are what are posted. They do have different positions on issues, but it's the qualifications that matter in Cuba. So the current situation is that they're projecting that there will be a sort of, instead of a single party, single person head of state, there will actually be two people. And it's that second person that's really being contested. There's one person who is seen as the likely guy as the vice president, and yet there's not a sure thing with that. So we should be seeing some information by the end of March, if not sooner, about the elections, which are a big deal. So Raul will stay on until 2021. But he will not be the head of state in that same role. Yes, let me go here, and then I'm coming back to you, Jim. Thank you. Go ahead.
If things were totally normalized, no embargo, no blockade, none of that, what would be the negative repercussions, if any, for the Cubans?
That is a great question. Do you want to take a first one? Or?
No, go for it.
Okay. I think the ironic answer to that question is that The Cubans have been living with our blockade, our lack of real trade and travel since the beginning of the triumph of the revolution, as they call it. And it's been used to explain some things that perhaps Cuba could have done differently or better. Cuba's the first country to say, we're not perfect. We don't have all the solutions. You've heard some good accomplishments. I hope you've also heard some concerns that we've tried to raise in all of these areas of example. But sometimes they have used the fact that they have had the blockade, and they've actually talked a lot about the fact that they've had a mono trading partner with the former Soviet Union, and that they did not diversify their economy. They did not get off of oil-based everything, transportation, agriculture, you name it, until it was too late. Now they've rebounded, but that's one of the things I could see in that area. And perhaps the fear might be there could be a backlash, and the people who have been winners might fear that they could be losers. So I'm not sure how it would happen. It's not happened in my lifetime until at least President Obama took some of the actions that he did by executive order, because the legislation that was passed by Congress in 1992 and 1996, the Helms-Burton Act, require Congress only, not the president, to end or normalize relations between our two governments. Anyone else want to?
Well, I think also the Cubans fear of being taken over by America. Well,
absolutely, and they should. I mean, you know, 55, 6, 7, 8 years.
Well, they're very proud of their culture.
Absolutely. They're a very proud country, a very, very proud country, and I think with good reasons. Okay.
And repeat what they say.
Oh, thank you. The question was, excuse me, what would there be any, if normalization of relations were to happen right now or soon, would there be any negative repercussions for the Cubans? Is that a fair statement of your question? Great. So let me go to Jim, and then let me also call on Hans.
Imani, how does the government run in terms of taxes? Where do the funds come to pay for all these social programs? Are there income taxes?
It's a great question. Someone else also asked that. There have not been... the question is how does the tax structure work? How does the system work in Cuba? And how do they pay for things, especially all of these social programs like healthcare? So I can't fully answer, and maybe somebody can, the full tax system, but I can say that because most of the businesses, the economic activity of Cuba has been under the government, all of the income comes back to the government. And then that is that then the creation of the priorities of the government, which have been primarily healthcare and education, arts, international solidarity, some other things, are again expended by the government. But as the economy has privatized and that there is now more individual ownership of businesses, then those people are now paying taxes to the government based upon the income that they are generating from their Casa Particulares, their Paladora restaurants, the small businesses, the joint ventures are a big income earner. And that's where the government retains 51% control of a joint corporation, let's call it. They call it joint ventures. And the other entity, which is most of the world, is retaining 49%. They're putting up the capital at 49%, and in many cases, the technical training, whether it's in, again, those three priority areas I mentioned before, tourism, pharmaceuticals, huge, huge scientific research investment in Cuba, and in telecommunications, and I like to say with my friend Hans back there, and possibly renewable energy. So that's how it's paid for. So you think about our country just trying to, they're not comparable, but just trying to say, what if we didn't want to spend all of the money we do on the military? What if we decided to put that money into healthcare and education? What if we had affordable housing? What if we had a clean environment? Every government makes choices. We make some level of choices by who we vote for. So that is what the government has chosen to focus on in Cuba. And I wish I could add a more detailed tax analysis, but one other part of it is I mentioned the tipping with the economy of tourism and the fact that the people who are working in tourism are making a lot more money than the people that are working for the basic Cuban peso. The actual tips that are collected, a third of those tips go to healthcare. So thank you for asking about healthcare. So people are paying into, if you will, their tipping into the healthcare system itself. I'm not aware of other programs that people would be paying into, but healthcare is the most important to make sure it's paid for so people still have that access to it. Okay. Oh, Hans, did you want to ask a question?
So to touch briefly on those couple of questions, to answer the healthcare life expectancy question, the average as of 2015 by the World Bank is 79 and a half years old. That's slightly higher than the average for both genders here in the U.S. To further the question over there, one of the biggest negatives that we have heard about is the embargo is used, as Jan mentioned, to lay the blame for failed projects on blockade rather than failed projects on the Cuban government. That's one of the concerns that has been brought up in previous delegations that I have taken down there, is that without the blockade, some of the programs can no longer have that, as it was put, scapegoat. And then finally, on the tax question, for the recent opening up of entrepreneurship, the tax bracket is somewhere between 25% and 37% in those private businesses and quintropropistas or entrepreneurs. Additionally, with the Trump administration's implementation against the military branches of the government, that is where a lot of the revenue for these social programs are coming in from. As Jan mentioned, whether it's tourism, whether it's healthcare, whether it's education, the military does have an extension in all of those areas. And the recent changes have majorly affected that, and it's hurting the Cuban people more so than the government at this point.
Thank you. Great. Excellent. Yes, please.
I had a question about affordable housing. Like, housing is a huge issue here everywhere in the States. How do they deal with that? And is there a difference with urban as opposed to rural?
Could you take that piece of
That's a good question. So along with the opening up of the economy. Oh, excuse me. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
She was wondering about affordable housing and how housing in general kind of works, right? So when Raul Castro made those economic changes, reforms that allowed people to buy and sell homes, that is now increasingly more common. Additionally, intergenerational housing is very common. So people live with their family members longer, and that can be in their family homes or apartments. So that just depends.
And I would just add that there really is no homelessness in Cuba.
How is it affordable?
Because most of the housing is subsidized like most of the other social programs. So you're really looking at, again, given those very few pesos a month people make, that a lot of their, you know, food ration for basic food items, the health care, the education, a variety of other areas are subsidized in Cuba. So it's hard for us to imagine in some ways how that can work, but it does work. Not for everybody, as I mentioned, and it's changing very rapidly with the inequality that is growing from the economic development of tourism and other areas, too. So, yeah, good question. Who else do we have back? Oh, you've been waiting. I'm so sorry. Please. And we're going to repeat the question right away. Thank you. We can be trained, Doug. Oh, I like that. No, just kidding.
Now, you mentioned the U.S. embargo. So are there no other trading partners with Cuba? So is it an embargo not only on the U.S. trade, but with other countries? So I want a clarification on that. And then also freedom of movement. Can people just pick up and leave Cuba and go to Canada?
The first question is Cuba. The first question is, are there other trading partners that Cuba has because of our embargo? blockade? And then secondly, what is the freedom of movement within Cuba? So within the first question, there is most of the world trades with Cuba. The irony is that up until the last year, where normally, unfortunately, the United States and Israel primarily have been the only two countries to vote against the UN vote on ending or lifting the embargo, even Israel has major industries in Cuba. We met a number of Israeli women, three or four, on our travel this last time. So even the people that are voting to keep the embargo are actually trading with Cuba. But for some companies, some corporations, they can't afford with their certain kinds of products to wait that 6 months or to shut out the U.S. market. So it's clearly hurting them in that way. But really, you just see so many joint ventures, and we're missing out, we believe, on those joint ventures. So the second part, freedom of movement has changed. It would be one of those myths that was true for a long time that Cubans couldn't leave the country unless they were leaving illegally on boats and rafts and whatever they could do to get out of the country. But there has been both a change in immigration policy, which I can say a little bit more about, but also the fact that right now, if the U.S. or other countries are processing visas, there's a payment to be able to travel, and usually the payment is $100 to $150 to $200 to be able to get a visa to travel. So when we bring Cuban speakers here, when we've been able to do that, we're fronting that money, and they don't often get, or they sometimes only get, that visa to travel. That's stopped not by Cuba at that point, it's stopped by the United States. But more Cubans are traveling, and what used to take place but changed around 2012 is the fact that when Cubans left the country, about a million left right after 1959, when they left the country, Cuba didn't want them back. So that has been a huge shift in reconciliation. Started with the artists. It started with the Ministry of Culture. Musicians wanted to come back. There's a great film I'm dying to show, if I can ever get a hold of it, on Havana, Havana. And it tells that story. But meanwhile, there's been conferences and gatherings that have been sponsored in D.C. at the Cuban Embassy. Our friend Jorge Quintana, who's a Cuban-American and involved in this work in Helena, has gone to some of these conferences, and they have a variety of reconciliation between Cuban-Americans and Cubans in Cuba and in the United States. But it wasn't that case for a while. It was really restricted in terms of travel, and nobody could afford it. So it was a double whammy for Cubans, and only a few, you know, special artists, musicians, writers, academics were getting out of the country to see other people. Yeah, let's hear from Eva, and then Doug. Ah, good question. We spent our last trip. Do they have a proactive environmental policy? Thank you. I thought I was trained. We spent our last trip in January exploring ecotourism, sustainability, community development. And we discovered a number of things. Most of the programs are very proactive, in part because of what took place during that so-called special period in the time of peace, which was that horrific, horrific economic degradation that took place in the 90s. And they had to go without, again, all the fossil fuels, period. So they were incredibly inventive, incredibly creative, to develop green, sustainable strategies. As they pulled themselves out of that special period, which some debate if it's ever ended, and others think it has not. I mean, it has. They've benefited. The desire to maintain a clean and healthy environment, not based so much on fossil fuels, has been a mainstay of Cuba. And as I mentioned briefly, that is why the World Wildlife Fund awarded Cuba the 2016 Country of the Year in Sustainability. And you see a lot of that. But you also see a lack of controls of cars and fumes. You see No, very little recycling. We were on two several explorations during this trip. One was to find the best mojito, and the second one was to find recycling programs. And we almost got to see a couple. We finally saw bins at the airport upon departure, but it has changed so much during the special period of the 90s when there was nothing to recycle. Every single bag was reused till it crumbled. People had cloth bags. People had nothing that we would even consider could be recycled. Water. You could drink the water in the 90s. You didn't need to buy bottled water. Now there's bottled water, and it's plastic everywhere. It's not because people are throwing it around, but it is definitely part of, you know, the good news is that they've got more products and they've got more opportunity with that. But the bad news is they haven't figured out how to manage that. And we talk about, we want to come back and do a cleanup or start a recycling program. We were just so conscious of that on this trip. And it's a part of the solution, but it's not the full answer to the question. But it's definitely worth coming to look at the ways in which they've used a variety of messages, priorities, to see how the ecotourism works and how green the country is. Thank you, Eva. Okay, last question, Mr. Doug.
What about press? Can you buy the New York Times, read the New York Times online?
Another great big question. I love that. And that's why we have to do more than just this. The question is, can he? What about the press, access to the press? Can he read the New York Times and a variety of places he mentioned? And what about access to the, can he read it online, access to the internet? So yes, you can if you can afford it, but it's mostly in the hotels where tourists are. I believe it's online. A lot of things are online now, and it's one of the most growing sectors of Cuba. But internet and media, which I'd love Lauren to speak to as well, has been complicated because of the cost of being able to have access. There was a cable set up from the government of Venezuela, which is not doing as well now, that was going to help increase access to the internet. And most people have cell phones. A lot of people have cell phones. And they go to the hotels and they stand outside next to the wall. And they're using the access to the internet, the Wi-Fi from that. We did too. Or sometimes we go inside. But the other part is the way in which Cuba tries to always have resources and access to resources in a way that's about community. So what they've built are community family internet centers in most neighborhoods, because very few people can afford computers, and very few people, unless your job allows it or is requiring it, it has access to the internet itself. So professors, doctors, you know, most of the professionals, easy, you know, when it's working access. But, you know, certainly probably people in the tourism industry. But it's very expensive. So we buy an internet card, and we spend one or two cooks or $1.25 per card, unless we get a good bargain on those 10-hour cards, 5-hour cards. But so we're buying those to then go to that point of access. Now, in Playa Larga, why don't you talk just briefly about Playa Larga's internet access, the internet park?
Yes.
Well, first of all, you have to trek to the internet park in the heat, which for us is difficult. But obviously, Playa Larga is a more rural area, not like Havana. So the internet, I'll say, with some air quotes, was very in and out, and also more expensive to purchase those internet access cards there as well. So it's really depending on where you're at on the island and what it affects what kind of access you have as well. So,
and so what they did also in Playa Larga, they have a park, a literal park with benches. They sell refreshments, and you all sit either underneath this roof, and you can buy your refreshment. Right next to it, they've got the pina colada stand. And then, or you can sit literally out front on the street and use your internet cards. But that's where everybody gathers, both Cubans, actually, and tourists, international visitors. You meet people from all over the world, everywhere in Cuba, and that's part of the other really good news. But it's still a struggle. It could lead to some have and have-nots, like we deal with in this country as well. But I think the fact that they continue to try to focus on what are cooperative, collective solutions to these access to these resources so everybody can have something versus just a few folks up in their room with their computer. So on that note, we are so happy to be here. Thank you for your patience. Loved your questions. Hope to see you again.